Well, if you've lived in Wisconsin for any time at all, you're probably familiar with the walleye. Maybe you have a story about catching a monster walleye. I have a few of those. Maybe while ice fishing. I have one great story related to that. But what about you? Or maybe it's your favorite fish to eat during one of our iconic fish fries here in the state. Whatever the case, it's certain the fish has a cultural hold in our state, not only our state, but I think the Midwest in particular. Larry Mueller here, by the way, and the author of the book Walleye, A Beautiful Fish of the Dark, is with us. Paul Radomski, he's a fisheries biologist and a lake ecology scientist. He's worked for more than 35 years on fisheries and lake management issues, and he has written a fascinating book. It's called Walleye, A Beautiful Fish of the Dark. So, what's your question about walleyes? What's your walleye story? Do you have questions about how walleye are stocked and harvest limits are set, perhaps? Join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Paul Radomski, good to have you with us. Thanks for joining in today.
No, it's a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Maybe, you know, a lot of people are familiar with walleye, but I think it'd be worth it to talk some walleye basics so everybody's sort of on the same page. You say the walleye are a beautiful fish of the dark. Why?
Well, maybe beauty is, of course, in the eye of the beholder, but I see them as having very functional beauty, right? They're colored on the top, white or yellow underneath. That is for counter shading, so predators or prey can't see them from above or from below, so it's really kind of interesting. And they have a lot of colors that blend in, so you could catch a brassy yellow walleye or an olive brown yellow or a gray blue. It's just kind of really diverse, and they're fully scaled for the most part. They're colored to blend in. Their scales have little small teeth on the edges, so as the walleye gets bigger, it becomes rougher and rougher to the touch. It's got two dorsal fins, with the first fin, you know, full of sharp spines, and when you pull it out of the water, it just glistens with that color. And the gill covers, you know, when near the mouth is serrated on the edge, so you got to be careful how you handle them. And then they've got very large teeth, dagger-like teeth, and some are curved inward so they can hold the prey that they catch a little bit better. And eyes, when you look at them, when you pull them out of the water, the first thing I see is these large eyes, right? The eye's pupil is fixed in size, and rimming it is a luminescent gold ring. There's no white of the eye to communicate surprise or fear. It's just this beautiful-looking eye looking back at you. And like dogs and cats and horses, the walleye have a black back of the eye reflector, which provides them better vision in low-light conditions. So that's kind of why I say their walleyes are the predators of the waning light or the dark areas, you know, the shadow areas in the lake, because they have this evolution adaption in their eye. They can feed on perch better and other prey that don't have that back of the eye reflector. And some of their competitors, like northern pike, don't have it. So they're gifted from the standpoint of their eye and how it's how they've adapted and evolved through time to better forage and compete in a complex water world that they live in. So it's very interesting from that standpoint.
It sure is. And maybe, you know, I think it's worth it. You know, they've been around for, as you say, right at the end of the book, I believe, you talk about their evolution. They've been around in one form or another for millions of years. And let's talk about the life of a walleye from start to finish. Can you give us a thumbnail on the life of a walleye? How it starts.
In fact, the book, I dedicate a whole chapter just to walk the reader through, you know, from eggs to fry to fingerling to adult walleye, just so they get a sense of it, because it's so different than our lives, right? And the demographics of a walleye population are so weird, right? So walleye spawn every year in the spring, and a female walleye, depending on its size, can deposit tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of these tiny brown-colored eggs. And just to talk about the demographics for a bit, if all those eggs were fertilized, hatched, and survived to adulthood, say, let's take Winnebago, for example. So if all those walleyes that laid those eggs, hatched, fertilized, et cetera, survived to adulthood, there'd be no room left or very little room left for water in the Winnebago system. It just boggles the mind, right? It's a crazy reproductive strategy. So the eggs, once they're spawned, they take about 21 days, depending on water temperature. Much, you know, it's kind of like a chicken egg, which is about 21 days. But with water temperature variability, they could hatch sooner if it's warmer, or less, or take longer if it's colder water. And then once they hatch, these little fry just escape this little capsule and get into the water column, either through drifting with the river or drifting with the water current to a lake. And they start feeding fairly shortly in a few days on zooplankton, little organisms that are feeding on algae in the lake. And as they grow, as they eat more algae, then they'll switch fairly quickly to larval fish. So it might be larval perch or gizzard shad, depending upon, you know, what's available. And they try to grow really fast. Their growth is, you know, pretty fast at this stage. And they try to keep ahead of the growth of their prey so that they can continually feed on that prey. And then, as a fingerling, they start being more sensitive to the light. So they start looking for places where they can hide in vegetation or go deeper, and might start schooling up a little bit. And their overwinter survival depends on how fast they grew that summer, how much fat they accumulated, how much energy they've stored up to survive that long, cold winter. And so oftentimes biologists will be looking at how many young fingerling in the fall there are, compare it and contrast it to previous years to say, well, how many fish do we think we're going to get, you know, as they mature. So, and then after that, they start, you know, they start just keep on feeding, right? So they'll feed throughout, mostly faster in the summer and a little bit less in the fall. And then in the winter, they kind of slow down quite a bit. So their metabolism depends on that water temperature. And then in about a couple of years, they might mature, depending upon where they are. You know, it's latitude dependent. So the further north, the longer it takes to mature. So it might be 3 or 4 years for a male, and then five or six for the female, depending on the conditions. And then once they're mature, they start, feeding just to sustain themselves. For females, they're looking to produce eggs every spring, and spawning occurs, you know, shortly after ice out. Water temperatures about 40 degrees are the peak time. And then they'll spawn in shallow areas around a lake. It might be over rock, rubble, gravel type of substrates. On Winnebago, they'll be doing it in the Wolf River, Upper Fox, and they'll be spawning on flooded marsh grasses and other things, which is really quite unique.
Yeah.
And then you start the whole cycle over again. It's just really fascinating biology once you get to understand the details of their life cycle.
Yeah, it really is. And you go from that to many chapters that deal with a whole range of things, including protecting the habitat or stocking, or one of my favorites chapters was on walleye harvest management. I learned a lot in that particular chapter, and we'll be able to talk some more about that as we go along through the show with our guest, Paul Radomski, fisheries biologist, a lake ecology scientist. He's worked for more than 35 years on fisheries and lake management issues. And I can tell you he's a good writer, and he's written the book, I think, on walleye. The title is Walleye, A Beautiful Fish of the Dark. And if you'd like to join in, you can call us. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, and we've got a few emails here we'll get to as well. The email address, ideas@wpr.org. And we'll get to your calls and we'll get to your emails right after we take a look at the news. And then we'll be back with Paul Radomski. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking about the book Walleye, A Beautiful Fish of the Dark on the show today. And we're doing it with Paul Radomski. He is a fisheries biologist, lake ecology scientist. He's worked for more than 35 years on fisheries and lake management issues. And he's penned this wonderful book on walleye. And from the history of the walleye to how it grows and lives to how it's managed, and takes a look at protection of habitat as well in his book. Hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. Have you fished Lake Winnebago, for example? He mentioned that earlier. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. You know, as you were talking about the life cycle of a walleye, Paul, you mentioned the eggs, of course, and that reminded me of the fact that a lot of those eggs are collected every year by fisheries managers and wind up being stocked. And I believe you point out we stock more walleye in the U.S. than any other fish. And stocking is what people want, but it's often a waste.
Yeah, it certainly can be. I live in Minnesota. Minnesota is the largest walleye stocker in the world. And Wisconsin's probably just right behind it. And Minnesota, Wisconsin, they have great understanding how to stock, where to stock. And, of course, people often ask or sometimes ask for stocking even if it's not appropriate. I always hear that people, well, it can't hurt. But, yeah, sometimes it can.
Yeah.
So, a lake can only hold so many walleye. It's the carrying capacity. So if you keep dumping walleyes in, you're going to get a law of diminishing returns. And after a certain amount that you put in, it you're just wasting those fish that could be better used stocked in other places, right? So that's the first thing. And then the other thing that occurs, especially starting to understand that issue here in Minnesota, is if you stock walleye on top of a natural reproducing population, it suppresses that population, and you end up with less walleye in the lake than if you didn't stock. So those are kind of lessons that biologists are learning to say, wait a minute, let's be pretty prudent and wise where we're going to stock these fish. And so we're not wasting resources and we're not damaging fisheries that, have natural reproducing walleye.
Yeah, and native walleye, I'm sorry, native walleye are going to outperform the released strains.
Yeah, I mean, they've evolved for that particular water body, whether it's a river or lake, and those native stocks of walleye are the best thing to have in a lake. You know, and here in Minnesota, we're the number one stocker, but if you look at, you know, the expense, yes, we're collecting a lot of walleye eggs for that stocking effort, but here, 85% of the walleye that are caught are all natural, free-ranging, all organic walleye that had no human hands that touched them. And the 15% are from the stocking. So even with huge efforts, you know, $4 million in Minnesota's stocking program, you know, and the high cost, you know, which translate to $8 per stock walleye caught, we really pale in comparison with what our natural lakes do. So in Minnesota, you know, the 200 to 300 natural lakes are just outproducing anything that a stocking program can produce. And it's the same way in Wisconsin, right?
Yeah.
You've got tremendous fisheries there. And stocking does help. It produces walleye fisheries that may not exist, but they're usually not to the same extent as your natural population. So that's always something to consider when the biologists are having discussions with lake groups or conservation groups, and having that discussion, well, will it work here? Why won't it work? You know, and having that honest and frank discussion about where is it appropriate. And those can be upsetting to some people. You know, they have a lake home and they want walleye, but it's, you know, mostly a bass lake. And if you put walleye in it, you may not see a lot of walleye in it after you stock it. So, you know, those are issues that I hear all the time.
Vivian in Green Bay, we'll give you a chance. Thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Well, I really enjoy river fishing, bass, northern walleye. And I have a question about the taste. In, to my mind, the cold water soon after ice out, as soon as you can legally fish, it seems to me that the fish taste better, particularly smallmouth bass. And that leads me to question what they're eating over the winter.
Yeah, they're often eating what they've been eating through the fall, so they don't usually shift too much in their feeding habits. They probably eat less because they're slowing down. They're not growing much through the winter. So I don't know if it's related to food, but maybe it's related to handling of the fish. You know, it might be with the cooler temperatures and quickly filleting it out, it just might be a fresher fish, right? I haven't noticed the difference in the fish that I consume, but I'm not necessarily a great tester on that as well. I love eating fish, and they all taste pretty good to me. So if you treat the fish you just caught right, and you cook it just right, I haven't had a problem like that. But maybe Larry, you've had something similar.
So I think the cold probably has the biggest impact. I mean, the fish gets cooled down right away, and I can remember ice fishing on New Year's Eve on Lake Mendota, and I dug my first hole. I was with a partner, and I said we were fishing for walleye, and I'm on my knees by my tip up, and I said, "This looks like a good spot." And as I was sitting there, the flag went up, almost hit me in the face. The fish bit like 1 minute after I had it, and turned out to be an 8.5-pound walleye.
Oh, wow. Beautiful fish.
A beautiful fish that we fished another hour and didn't get another bite. And we went home and took some pictures and ate the fish. And it was delicious.
Yeah. That's the thing with walleye fishing. It can be really slow, or you can get, you know, the bite can be really good. And you do really well. And that's what makes walleye fishing so fun. Or not. You know, often my dad would say, "You took me to Lake Empty." We haven't caught anything all day, and then we might go back to that same lake and do really well. And, you know, it's just a matter of, you know, how hungry the walleye are on that particular day, right?
Lynn in Sister Bay, your turn. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. How are you doing?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I've been fishing for salmon up here for over 40 years. And as anybody will tell you, our fishery has just gone down the drain. Used to have 8 charter guys up on the North Tip. They're all out of business. Are the walleye, do they bear any responsibility here? What is causing, are the walleye eating the salmon eggs? Why have we seen such a horrible, horrible disappearance of the salmon over in the bay?
Yeah, that's a good question. I wouldn't blame walleye. Walleye don't forage on salmon eggs or anything like that. Certainly they are competitive to some of the forage fish, but my understanding is it could be related just to the available forage, and it wasn't like what it was before when salmon fishing was at its peak, and the lakes and the bay had changed, and with that change, you know, it affects the number of predators it can support, and in your case, the number of charters or people that can go out and fish for them. So it's a dynamic system that they're living in, and some of these waters are changing. You know, you get new arrival of species, you get differences in water quality, and all these things play together and affect the number of predator fish that you might have in a system.
Yeah. Lynn, thank you for calling. Gary in Madison, your turn. Hi, Gary.
Hello. I was wondering, is it safe to eat walleye that are caught in Lake Mendota?
Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to mention there are the DNR posts advisories. And I imagine some of that happens in Minnesota, too, Paul.
Yep.
So maybe so, in general, I would say you can go to the DNR website and take a look at just put in fish advisories, and you'll find out about what it says about Lake Mendota or any other lake in the state. But maybe you have a comment.
Yeah, that is true, Larry. Most state agencies have fish consumption advisories that look at, you know, the common contaminants, mercury, PFAS, which are becoming more common in fish, and PCBs. So most agencies look at those common contaminants and say, can you eat those fish? Of course, if you're young or a woman that's pregnant or to be pregnant, then they'll have different recommendations generally. Yeah, I would always do that if you're concerned and are interested to look at those advisors and see what is safe to eat.
And sometimes it depends on the weight of the fish too.
Yeah, often for mercury, for example, the bigger the fish, the more likely it's bioaccumulating in its tissue. So the bigger the fish, the more likely it's going to be contaminated for those kinds of pollutants.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to go to one chapter that you had on harvest management. That chapter to me was very, as a social scientist, I was really interested in that because harvest management, you talk about creel limits, for example. Well, you talk about something called exploitation rate, which refers to the harvest rate,
right,
and creel limits, which means the number of fish that you can legally take out of a specific lake. You talked about the fact that essentially creel limits serve as a check on greed. For just specific individuals or specific groups of people rather than the collective of fisher people.
Yeah, creel limits are often misunderstood because with walleye fishing, unlike some other species that you might fish with for, most people for an angling trip don't catch a walleye. And then, you know, a small percentage of do catch the limit. So it's this unusual distribution of how many walleye an angler group or an angler will catch. And since most people catch, you know, 0 to 2 fish, you know, a limit reduction from 5 to whatever might not have an effect. But there are lakes, there are rivers that a creel limit would have an effect. Those systems tend to be where walleye are very vulnerable or very catchable, right? So as you go north, they're more vulnerable because you have less forage base. So those kind of cases where creel limits make some sense. Winnebago changed theirs a couple of years ago. It made sense because, you know, they're fishing a system where creel limits do have an impact. So, but most waters, that's probably not the case. So it is, the limit is often a bragging right? Right? Well, I caught my limit today. It's a social effect. It's a way to measure how well you've done in contrast to, say, you know, your friend or your buddy that's fishing with you. So.
we're not getting into all of it here on the show. We don't have time, but that is just a fascinating chapter to me about how agencies use lower creel limits to curtail angling pressure.
Yeah, it certainly works in many places where you have a lot of lakes, right? You go change the creel limit on reduce it, and then that shifts anglers to a spot that they want to hopefully catch more fish and bring more fish home for the family meal. So they change where they want to go depending upon what the creel limit. So state agencies have used that as kind of a rough way to regulate fishing pressure on a particular lake. That sometimes works, sometimes it doesn't work, but certainly it's been used as a tool for that purpose.
Anne in St. Germain wonders if you know the percentage of Wisconsin lakes that are believed to have had walleye populations before stocking began.
Oh, no, that's a great question. I don't know that. I know in Minnesota, the stocking programs added about 1,000 lakes that didn't have walleye, that have fishable walleye populations today. So these lakes were, you know, small or medium-sized lakes where walleye, for whatever reason, walleye never got there, right? Stocking, you know, there was habitat there. They can self-reproduce there or at least continue their population. And I suspect that maybe these similar percentages for Wisconsin as well, that they probably produced a large number of lakes that have fishable populations of walleye that didn't have them prior to stocking.
You and Lake Winnebago has come up a couple of times, and you have a really nice chapter on Lake Winnebago, which is our largest inland water fishery in Wisconsin. And you spent a bunch of time with Kendall Kamke on how they work with how the DNR here, he's the fish manager, DNR fish manager, he has a huge volunteer army to help really keep Lake Winnebago going for walleye.
It's a fascinating to connect back with Kendall. By the way, he just recently retired. So I talked to Kendall and Adam Nickel, another biologist that works there, really great biologist. And you know what I came to learn about the Winnebago system, besides the unique fishery that's there, you know, it's got the drum that are very abundant, white bass, lake sturgeon. It's just a fascinating, water body.
You call the sturgeon the elephant of Lake Winnebago and the walleye the lion.
Yeah, just so people could relate to something. But it is that really unique fish community there. But what really I got to understand as I talked to Kendall and Adam, as well as Mike Arrowwood with Walleye for Tomorrow, that this was an outstanding public citizen community work that protects and restores the river habitat that allows that abundant walleye population to exist. And it allows walleye to move upstream to spawn. Their habitat work allows the river to connect to its floodplain. But it's been, they've been doing this since the 60s. So biologists come and go, right? I mean, they start young and they retire just like Kendall did. But they had this great relationship with the communities and with citizens and anglers. And I was just amazed at the endurance and perseverance of that collaboration, right? Because it really takes that collaboration when you've got such an altered watershed like Winnebago, that you can still sustain and still protect that habitat and restore it where you can. And it was interesting. You talked to the biologists, Kendall and Adam, and they point to the great active citizens in the community and conservation groups. And then I was talking to Mike Arrowwood, and he goes, well, I give all the credit to the Wisconsin DNR biologists. And they're both pointing to each other. Saying, you know, those folks are doing great work, and they're really helping us out. And you know, that just shows you the strength of that relationship and the need for, you know, that community and anglers to come together and work with the you know, the DNR to get really important things done. And the whole chapter just talks about all the great work that they've done. And I walked away after I've had those conversations with them and going, wow, that's just amazing. That they've been doing that for so long and so successful. And they've had a string of great biologists at Winnebago. And I think that's, you know, that's part of it. And it is just a very interesting story.
Oh, it is indeed. And it's something, and it's just one of the many features of your book that I so enjoyed. There's another a whole nother section on protection of habitat that involves a conversation about climate change and cost-benefit analysis when it comes to protecting habitat, when it comes to walleye. And here we are out of time. We don't have time to talk about it in more detail, Paul. But I want to thank you so much for writing this book. I had a technician at my home last night, and he saw my copy, and he took a quick photo of the cover because I was enthusiastically telling him about it. Thank you very much for being with us and for writing the book. It's much appreciated, Paul.
Thank you for having me today.
Paul Radomski is the author of Walleye, A Beautiful Fish of the Dark. And whether you fish or not, I think you'd enjoy reading this book. Tomorrow on the show, we'll uncover how you can learn more about your DNA and genealogy. Plus, we'll look at what you can grill for Thanksgiving. That's tomorrow at 11 on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.